This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. This summer, protesters across the world tore down statues of colonizers and Confederates, and they turned their gaze to museums, too. In Paris in June, protesters unsuccessfully attempted to remove a 19th century South Sudanese funeral pole from a museum. They said the item was looted during colonization and needed to be returned. The violent theft of thousands of works of African art by mostly Western powers is well documented, but the pieces remain in the collections of Western museums. Is it time to return Africa's looted art, and how should that process play out? Joining us now from New Jersey is Chika Okeke-Ogulu. He's a professor of African and Africa diaspora art at Princeton University. Professor Okeke-Ogulu, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
So you're a scholar of African art, but for you, this is more than an academic or ethical debate. It's personal. You protested the sale of two Nigerian ceremonial wooden statues at the auction house Christie's in June of this year. Tell us about these pieces.
Well, these were called Alosi figures that would have been installed in shrines in southeastern Nigeria in the Igbo culture area in present-day Anambra State. And part of the reason I became very personally engaged with this is that my mother had told me stories about how when she was a young woman, she belonged to an age grade that would, on an annual basis, would go decorate these statues for specific annual festivals. And they are representations of spirit forces that were part of the Igbo pantheon. And you found them in many shrines in eastern Nigeria, but until the Nigerian Civil War, also called the Biafran War of 1967 to 1970. During that period, vast amounts of these objects were looted, stolen by traders who sold them off to middlemen, who then sold them off to European dealers from whence they arrived in many European collections. And so, for me, it's part of the tremendous loss that my generation felt and still feel resulting from that war, not just lives that were lost in some reports millions, but also the cultural devastation that that war visited on my own people. And so as a historian, as an art historian, and as a scholar, I'm very much invested in Igbo art studies or African art studies and so forth, as are a lot of my colleagues. But it's also a very personal endeavor that some of these histories have to be recovered. Precisely because the stories, the accounts of these objects that you find in museums hardly ever mention how they arrived in these museums.
So you...
And for that reason, a lot of things get lost in terms of what narratives these museums tell about these objects.
So you saw these ceremonial statues on the auction block at Christie's. What did you do after you realized these were up for auction?
Well, I did what any, if you will, public commentator would do, which is to go on social media. I went to my Instagram and complained loudly about the fact that these objects were being offered for sale. And so from there, a lot of attention by print, news media, television stations across the world got into this whole question. And for me, it was really to announce as loudly as I could that the sale and collection of these objects, which for me are tainted with the blood of children of Biafra, and I'm a Biafran child. Many among my generation did not survive that war. And so to see them being bought and sold in the market, as Christie's, you know, did, was and is offensive, really, to me. And I just had to announce that it's no longer business as usual. Some of us now have the voice to actually complain loudly and be heard, whereas previously that wouldn't have been possible. And so I needed to use my voice to call attention to this terrible, odious history of careless criminal collecting that have basically enriched private and public collections of African art in Europe and the Americas.
How did Christie's auction house respond? Because the sale did go forward, correct?
Yes, it did. Well, they responded as I expected, even if it was I was completely and utterly disappointed. But I thought that that's what they were going to do, which is they must have weighed, and I know that they did, weigh their options. Will there be too much negative coverage about the sale? And what about their commercial commitments to make money? I think the latter consideration won the day, which is to say they needed to make money. After all, it's supposedly free market world that we live in. And so they basically went ahead to sell off the objects, at the same time making really surprisingly untenable claims and arguments about these objects. At first, they mentioned where exactly these objects were taken from, which towns in Igbo land, which is, and these towns are about 30 miles from my own hometown in Anambra State. When I called them out on that this town is in eastern Nigeria, and at the time that they said the French dealer who first got it out of West Africa collected the work, that there was a war going on. And so how is it possible, how is it legal that these objects came out of a war zone in eastern Nigeria? They quickly went and changed their information on the website to take out the location, and then to start claiming, well, it wasn't collected by people other than Nigerians or Nigerian traders, as if to say, well, it's not our fault. However, it came out of Nigeria, it was by Nigerians, even if, you know, illegally so. And so basically tried to absolve themselves of any of the charges that I had levied in my posting, which didn't get anywhere because no one believed any of the stuff that they tried to assert about these objects. And so they went ahead to sell the objects. For me, as I said, it was disappointing, but it was was also expected. But what I want to guarantee to traders and dealers like the Christie's is that each time these things, if they insist on selling them, there will be vehement rejection of these gestures. Because as I said, it's no longer defensible. I cannot find any good argument for the sale and dealing of objects that were taken out of a war zone. There is no law anywhere to protect them. After all, in fact, the Hague Convention on Protection of Cultural Property in the event of armed conflict of 1954 protects objects like the Alosi figures that were taken out of Nigeria in time of conflict. So the point really is that the open market where these objects are being sold is indefensible. And voices like mine and others who have come on stream will continue to point to the illegality of these kinds of transactions until institutions like the Christie's realize that these are toxic objects to be buying and selling. Instead, if anything, they should be contributing to any conversation about what to do about illegally expropriated, looted, and stolen objects.
Let's pause here for a moment. We're talking to Chika Okeke Ogulu, an art history professor at Princeton University. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment. This is 1A. I'm Jen White. According to a 2018 study commissioned by French President Emmanuel Macron, 90 to 95% of Africa's cultural objects are held outside the continent. Many of those works were stolen during colonization and are displayed without any explanation of their violent, looted past. It's a point the movie Black Panther made well. In this scene, the character Killmonger is browsing an exhibition with a curator.
Tell me about this one.
Also from Benin, 7th century, Fula tribe, I believe.
Nah.
I beg your pardon.
It was taken by British soldiers in Benin, but it's from Wakanda, and it's made out of vibranium. Don't trip, I'm gonna take it off your hands for you.
These items aren't for sale.
How do you think your ancestors got these? You think they paid a fair price? Or did they take it like they took everything else?
There's a push today for museums to return their stolen African loot. And I'm talking, joining us to talk about it is Chika Okeke Ogulu, an art history professor at Princeton University. And I want to bring two more guests into the conversation. Dan Hicks is a professor of contemporary archaeology and curator at the Pitt Rivers Museum at the University of Oxford. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, The Brutish Museums, The Benin Bronzes, Colonial Violence, and Cultural Restitution. Professor Hicks, welcome to 1A.
Hello there. Hi.
And also with us is Deborah Mack, the interim director of the National Museum of African Art. Deborah, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So, Dan, I'm hoping you can give us a little more context about what we know about what museums are holding, how many of these artifacts are being held in museums, and a little bit more about their history.
And so I'm sorry, was that for me?
Yes, Dan, sorry about that.
Okay, yeah, that's fine. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, overall, I mean, our Western museums hold a wide range of African objects. And often, yeah, museums themselves really don't understand all that well, you know, what they hold and sort of how it got there, you know, themselves. So in a lot of ways, the histories, you know, that we were hearing about a moment ago from the 60s and the 70s, you know, have a longer term history. They have a history in which really the violent acts through which objects were removed were not just some sort of, you know, effect of empire. They were actually a central, you know, activity, you know, that was being undertaken, you know, as a part of the military expansion of, you know, Europe across Africa, in which really, you know, museums were, if you like, a very modern source of your device in order to, which were used in order to show objects, which were really, you know, looted, and almost to sort of, you know, justify that violence. And so I think increasingly for audiences now, you know, objects in a museum, you know, that were taken with violence are understood as a, you know, memorial to anti-African, you know, violence. And so these are the questions our audiences here in Oxford, here in the, you know, UK and across, you know, yeah, Europe are really asking at the moment. They're asking, you know, what is, you know, the meaning of these displays? And, you know, is it enough really simply to rewrite the label in order to tell that history? Or actually is the presence of, you know, this object here in, you know, Europe actually itself an ongoing act of violence, an act that sort of, you know, naturalizes these, you know, these arguments, you know, that, you know, really, you know, made in the 1890s and onwards about, you know, cultural evolution, you know, that were so linked into, you know, military victories. So we're really, you know, wrestling with that past, I think, in, you know, museums as these really unique, you know, public forums for having, you know, conversations about empire and its ongoing effects.
Deborah, what do you know about looted works in the Smithsonian's collection? How much information do you have about what works you have and how they came into the Smithsonian's possession?
Well, I think it's important for listeners to understand that the National Museum of African Art does follow the broader Smithsonian Institution policies around cultural property. And so there are very detailed, very regulated, and well-documented steps to basically document not only what might be considered an acquisition or go into collections, but even in anything that might be borrowed. There are, of course, the legalities that began with NAGPRA, the National Native American Graves Repatriation Act in the 70s, and the other more globalized acts that that our colleagues have referenced. But for instance, the National Museum of African Art does have indeed some 40 plus objects of Benin Kingdom artworks. And these are among the artworks that, as you referenced in the movie Black Panther, are highly illustrated as examples of looted objects. The collections, the objects that are in the African art collections are well documented. We know the provenance of every piece that has been transferred to the museum through private gifts or through acquisition, and pieces that we have selected not to acquire that are in these collections. I think it's important to also understand that members of the royal court, the Oba of Benin, in fact, several former Obas, including the current one, and the royal court, have come through and continue to come through the National Museum of African Art. They have gone into collections. They have looked at the storylines. They have looked at current exhibits. Our curators and our researchers are in deep and ongoing conversations with them about how these objects were acquired, how, and when I say acquired, we like to think of them as really being on indefinite loan. I think that what our colleagues are actually referencing in is this larger picture of a total transformation of museum practice that has to do much more with learning, with training, with exchange. It is about making museums more equitable, inclusive, empowering spaces that address these legacies and have to do so explicitly. Those legacies may be in deep history and they may be completely current right now. And they deal with colonialism, they deal with slavery, they deal with multiple levels of practice and interpretation. But they are part of this larger practice of restitution that is not only around collections, but about practice in general.
Well, Dan, the Benin bronzes in particular have become a focal point in the debate over repatriation of African art. We just heard them mentioned in that clip from Black Panther. Can you give us a very quick history lesson on why those have become a focal point of this conversation?
I think that the Benin bronzes are, with several other forms of art among the best known. They are first of all royal art. You know, this is art that is really created by employed royal artists. It is commissioned royal art. And there were the courtly arts of particularly bronze casting and ivory carving that are a high point of distinguished workmanship that are known historically. But again, this is art that is commissioned by someone who's not only the political and cultural leader, but in many respects, spiritual leader of his community, of what was the Kingdom of Benin, now Benin City in Nigeria. Because it was also an art form that was so, I believe, unanticipated by outsiders. They were, in many respects, shocked by not only the beauty, but the levels of craftsmanship, the range of objects, the amount of these objects. That 1897 raid, which was an act of war, in which thousands of pieces were confiscated from the royal court. And this was done by soldiers, by administrators, by many others. And as colleague Dr. Okeke Agulu references, there's an entire network of how these things move across across the country, outside the country, and into private collections.
Deborah, what is the Smithsonian's position on the return of works in its collection that you know can be traced to looting?
Well, the Smithsonian has several museums, not only the National Museum of African Art, that have been dealing with this for a very long time. And so there are defined steps around repatriation, around restitution, where there are processes that really specify the kinds of cultural items that are in museum collections that the museum can be approached for a discussion about return to not only lineal descendants, but culturally affiliated organizations and communities. And this is beyond art. It's human remains. It's funerary objects, other sacred objects, objects of cultural patrimony. All of these kinds of materials, including quote-unquote art, are materials that are under consideration, that can be considered. And there's a very elaborate process. Listeners may want to go to the website at Smithsonian to see how elaborate that process is. But nothing is off the table. Again, it is a process that's been in place at Smithsonian for more than 30 years, and it is expanding. But it is only one element of a much larger transformation of collaborative practice and partnership.
I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A. We're talking to Deborah Mack, Interim Director of the National Museum of African Art, Chika Okeke Ogulu, Professor of African and Africa Diaspora Art at Princeton University, and Dan Hicks, author of the forthcoming The Brutish Museums, The Benin Bronzes, Colonial Violence and Cultural Restitution. Well, after the theft of the bronzes in the late 1800s, around 40% of the artifacts were given to the British Museum in London, and it's retained most of that collection. I had a phone call yesterday with Lisant Bolton, the head of the Africa, Oceania, and the Americas department there. And I asked her how her institution is responding to calls for repatriation.
People always want a black and white, a yes and no. But as for many things in life, it's not always as straightforward as yes and no or black and white. There are many different aspects to these questions. And I think there's a real danger of us being a bit, I mean, people may disagree with me about this and I will accept it. But there's a bit of a danger of Europeans becoming a bit neo-colonialist about this and saying these things must go back, and we've saying that these things must go back. Now, I suspect that many people in different parts of the African continent will also say we would like to see these things come back. That's a different thing. But I would rather talk to a person in representing a community engaged with collections that come from their history than I would necessarily wish to speak to an activist who might want who's pursuing a particular claim.
So in the case of the Benin bronzes, where mm-hmm. members of the royal family have called for those to be returned,
yes,
in that context, does that then mean that the British Museum would agree and say, yes, these are items of importance to the Benin people, we should return them?
We have been asked to give things back. In fact, the director of the British Museum, Hartwig Fisher, and I and a colleague were in Benin City a couple of years ago, and we were very privileged to have an audience with the Oba. And he did ask for things back, but he also asked that some objects remain in Europe to act as ambassadors for the tremendous civilization, the kingdom of Benin, and to represent them. So these questions are not immediately always just yes, no. There's more to it than that.
Professor Okeke Ogulu, I'd love to hear your response to what we just heard there.
Yes. Well, the question is, where do we go from here? Whether we're talking about the Smithsonian or the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York or the Field Museum in Chicago and other American institutions that hold significant amount of these Benin objects, which, by the way, I should mention that part of the reason that the Benin royal art is so much at the forefront of these debates about restitution is that it's probably one of the most well-documented histories of colonial expropriation. There's a very well-documented account of what was taken, the numbers, the types, and all of that. And we know the date. We know where these things came out of. And we know that the current Oba of Benin is a great-great-grandson of the Oba who was the king of Benin at the time these things were taken. In other words, the documentation is so very clear how they came out of Benin and how they were distributed in that initial moment after 1897 to private and public collections in Europe and then the United States. Mm-hmm. So we have very good information about provenance, which is usually the, let's say, for someone like me, the excuse that museums often give for not even trying to return things. There's always this thing about we need to do provenance research. The provenance of the Benin objects is already there and well established. But the other thing is that for the these Benin objects, the Oba of Benin has asked for them to be returned. Yes, it's very complex a question and problem of actually moving them from one location to the other. But the question is, are these institutions actually committed to the return of these objects? Because there's a fundamental question of ownership.
I'm going to have you pause right here. Please hold that thought. We got this email from Brian who says, isn't it funny we glorify the fictional treasure hunter Indiana Jones who's trying to do the right thing by stealing various artifacts to save them to be displayed in Western museums as opposed to letting them become the private property of some wealthy criminal collector? Times are changing indeed. We're discussing the return of Africa's looted art with Smithsonian's Deborah Mack, Professor Dan Hicks of Oxford University, and Professor Chika Okeke Ogulu from Princeton. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and from our guests in a moment. Let's get back to the debate over whether and how to return the massive amount of stolen African art that's spread across museums, mainly in Europe and the U.S. My guests are curator at the Pitt Rivers Museum and professor at Oxford University, Dan Hicks, head of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African Art, Deborah Mack, and Princeton art history professor, Chika Okeke-Agulu. Deborah and Dan, I want to hear from you on this. The president of France directed items to be returned in 2018, but they haven't yet. You both say you support repatriation, but work at museums with stolen African art that has not been returned. What do you think the holdup is? Dan, I'll come to you first.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, so yes, I think, I mean, we've been, I mean, as we've heard for really, you know, 30 years or so, Western institutions have been attempting to have these, you know, dialogues. And of course, you know, restitution itself is an African movement, African-led movement that dates back, you know, almost a century. You know, why has that dialogue not moved into action? Well, I think we see in France, you know, a very different sort of situation in that the African objects held by the state are in a single, you know, museum. It's a lot easier to make a decision about, you know, those objects in a centralized way. However, in the UK, in the USA, you know, actually these objects are spread across a whole range of institutions. So it isn't only national museums, it's Ivy League institutions, Harvard and Penn and so forth, who hold looted African objects, you know, whether from Nigeria in that incident, you know, that we mentioned at the end of the 19th century, or whether it's other African objects as well. So I think the challenge, and in some ways actually maybe the hope, is that what we're seeing is a whole range of conversations happening in a range of different institutions. So the protests in New York about statues are moving their attention now to African objects inside museums. There were protests at, you know, RISD, Rhode Island, about the Benin, you know, object, which is there. So I think in each of these, you know, museums has its own audiences, has its own local, you know, audiences who will have an opinion. And I think in the wake of everything that's happened in the past, you know, 6 months, where actually, you know, museums are absolutely at the cutting edge of asking, well, how is it that we have seen, you know, restitution advance in all sorts of, you know, really important ways for essentially indigenous and, you know, First Nations, you know, context, and yet Africa is, and indeed African-American audiences are left out of these, you know, conversations. And so I think we're seeing that really alter at the moment. And I'm hopeful, actually, that we're going to see a more, you know, complex, but maybe a more action-oriented dialogue.
Briefly, Deborah, your thoughts. Why do you think this is such slow going?
I can only speak really for the National Museum of African Art, where, again, while there are Benin Kingdom collections, only some of them come from that period that's under contestation. And the Oba of Benin and the Royal Court have clarified that they would like those objects to remain at African Art because of the comprehensive historical context that's provided in sharing this art with viewers and, I should say, on site and online, because all of our materials are available digitally as well. However, it's important to note that the Museum of African Art is a relatively recent museum, and so the majority of collections have not been originated in the kinds of contested ways and contested eras. Having said that, it is, I believe, a watershed time where the concept of African art is moving beyond, shall we say, nation states and borders and even immediate communities. Global Africa is global, and African descended people, people who originate in one place but may live in another, people who are removed by generations, recognize this as part of a global call that has taken on, I think, speed and power and scope. These are about narratives that have historically been sort of, I'll say, segregated by geography or by nationality or national borders. That is no longer the case. I think we all recognize that this requires a global lift and a collaborative lift. It's also really talking about, this is one element that's just sort of in the center of a much larger call for larger restitution, because it's recognized that objects that are taken, in no matter how they originate, they disrupt memory, they disrupt histories, they disrupt meaning making, they disrupt traditions, and they also disrupt the creation of new traditions and memories.
Well, to that
and,
end,
in both when both, I believe, tangible and intangible heritage are looted.
Well, Dan, I want to hear from you. Can you share a story of any successful returns of stolen African art?
Of course, yes. And so, already, I think, you're talking about the example of, you know, Nigeria, 1897, the Benin attack in which tens of thousands of Nigerians were killed and, you know, thousands of artworks were taken. You know, one of these objects washed up at a Cambridge college in the 1930s. It just sat on a shelf in the common room of the college all of that time. But then 5 years ago or so, a conversation among students, faculty at the college really began about, well, what is this cockerel, you know, the brass, you know, cockerel, you know, why is it here? You know, what's it doing here? It had come from an old boy of the college who had served as a soldier in that expedition. And that's really where a lot of these objects really, you know, began. The hundreds of soldiers and others involved in that enormous, you know, naval raid actually, you know, brought objects back. And the sheer violence of that incident is really visible in the hundreds of incidents of essentially objects in a range of different institutions around the world, across the US and around the world. So in that instance, you know, a decision was made, you know, by the college after you're talking to students, after you're contacting the Royal Court, that you know, cockerel will, you know, return. I think it also underlines the fact, though, that actually restitution, you know, doesn't have immediately to say, well, you know, actually, is this object at risk if it goes back? I mean, the cockerel is in Cambridge at the moment, and it will return, you know, actually, you know, when the museum, you know, which is being built, is opened. So you can transfer ownership. And this is actually something I would love to see in the United States, you know, happening as part of this, you know, mix of conversations. Why not hand over the legal title, you know, to those, you know, kings and others, you know, royal courts from whom, you know, objects were taken, and then it's really, you know, the agency is then, you know, with Africans, you know, to make their own decision about, you know, where these objects are and when. And I think in that instance, you know, that's a really, really good answer that really, you know, we could learn from in the wider museums.
Well, I want to listen to a bit more of my conversation with Lisant Bolton from the British Museum in London. Here's what she had to say about how looted African art is displayed.
In the case of the Benin bronzes, we make that history quite clear. In the case of other objects, you know, I have to tell you that the visiting public might be incredibly bored by an exhibition in which all the labels merely said how the objects came into the museum. So there's a bit of a balance in terms of what the exhibition is about, what you're trying to say. We might be trying to celebrate something about that particular time and place. We might be wanting to expand people's understanding of a really important bit of world history. And so we have to think, what can we fit on the label? There is a lot of really interesting things to say about every object.
We also got this message from Melanie on Facebook, who says, while we're at it, maybe we can question the problem of museum organization, too. Why are artifacts from the Ivory Coast positioned directly adjacent to those from the Pacific Islands, with little to demarcate that they are not geographically or culturally similar? Seems to me the organization of displays and galleries in many museums is blatant othering stemming from a colonizing worldview. I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A. Chika, I'd like to hear from you on this. How much of this is also about a conversation around how African art and artifacts are presented?
Well, clearly, the museological practices we have today have changed somewhat from previous years and decades in terms of the kinds of issues, the kinds of questions that curators in these museums are asking about the objects, the kinds of narratives that they're producing for their audiences and so forth. Especially given that curatorial work, at least in major museums, have become increasingly seen as a scholarly and intellectual activity rather than simply a matter of collecting and describing objects and so forth. So the narratives are changing somewhat. But to return to this, how narrative and display are connected to this broader problem of restitution, I think the British Museum curator pointed to this when she says that you don't want to bore your visitors with how things came into the museum for each object. That's fair. But what you see in a number of museums is a lack of interest or perhaps even will to point to these histories, because you cannot divorce these objects from those histories, especially if these are objects that come from an elsewhere, right? The Americas, Oceania, Africa departments in these big institutions. You have to account for not just the aesthetics, the cultural context, but also the specific histories of how did these things come into the space. These are very important elements to the nature of, in quotes, our relationship with the other. They didn't just appear in our local museum here in New York or in London or in Bremen, wherever. So I think that the question of the stories that museums tell of these objects are very important. And one could look at American museums, for instance. The kind of effort that, let's say, the British Museum has made in telling the history of the Benin art objects in its collection is so important and in my opinion, well narrated. But you don't find stuff like that in museums like the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, where you look at the provenance and it just says something like Court of Benin. And you wonder, how did it come from Court of Benin to here? Other museums have made more effort. The Museum of Fine Arts in Boston has acknowledged in its labeling, in its narrative, within the context of the display of these objects. And for me, this is crucial. Beside the question of physical relocation, beside the question of ownership, the nature of the knowledge and history that museums, because they are educational institutions, the nature of the information, the nature of the stories that they tell of these objects is very fundamental to the acknowledgement of the global dimensions, right, of both collecting, but also the nature of interactions between societies and cultures over time. And this can be more adequately accounted for in the provenance histories, but also in the cultural context that they bring to bear in the labels, in the narratives, display narratives that accompany these objects in the museums.
Well, Dan, we only have about 30 seconds here, but what are the next steps in this conversation as museums continue to grapple with this question?
And so really, you know, as ever, it's a case-by-case approach. You know, actually, you know, this has to be led by, you know, restitution, you know, requests from Africa, but we have to hear those requests. We have to respond to them. In the United States, the Benin objects run from, you know, Denver to, you know, DC to New York, but you know, yeah, many, many other institutions. And so we really need to listen to the African claims and, on a case-by-case basis, we'll do our best to see these objects returned.
That's Dan Hicks, a professor of contemporary archaeology and curator at the Pitt River Museum at the University of Oxford. His book, The Brutish Museums, The Benin Bronzes, Colonial Violence and Cultural Restitution, is coming out this November. Also with us, Chika Okeke-Ogulu, a professor of African and an African-American diaspora art at Princeton University, and Deborah Mack, who leads the Smithsonian's National Museum of African Art in Washington, D.C. Thanks to all of you. Remember, we have a text club. We'll only ever send you one text a day. It's the fastest way to connect with us. Details about how to sign up can be found in the Ask 1A tab at the1a.org. Today's producer was Avery Kleinman. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.